Welcome to this week's HPS Cast. I am your host, Colbert Cannon, and let me tell you a little bit about HPS and what you're listening to today. HPS is a global investment firm. We manage over $60 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. I sit in the private credit side of the house, and I spend time finding opportunities to deploy our capital into a range of interesting situations, mergers and acquisitions, refinancings, etc. The central premise of our show is simple. We are entrusted as stewards of capital by our investors, and we entrust that capital to management teams to help drive value creation. This podcast is intended to talk to key relationships of HPS about how they got to where they are today and how those experiences help them drive value creation on a day-to-day basis for themselves and for their stakeholders. This podcast will introduce those business leaders to you, our listeners, and it is our hope that through those interviews, you will get a little bit of a better sense of who we, HPS, are through the lens of our key constituents internally and externally. Our guest today is a leading allocator of capital. He is a senior portfolio manager for a large trust, investing capital out of a $40 billion portfolio to provide retirement benefits to over 400,000 plan participants. He leads their credit portfolio, directing investments across public and private credit asset classes. A product of the ACC, after Georgia Tech for undergrad and Wake Forest Business School, he spent time at several investment firms in Atlanta, focused on fixed income and credit opportunities. For the last 8 years, he has been at UPS Group Trust, which invests for the benefit of the retired fine women and men who deliver packages to your door every day. So without any further ado, let me introduce this week's HPS Cast guest, Robert Thompson, Senior Portfolio Manager at UPS Group Trust. Robert, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Colbert. Pleasure to be here.
Robert, let's go back to the beginning. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Sandy Springs, Georgia, which is about 1 mile from UPS headquarters. So I really ventured out of my comfort zone.
When you were a kid, what did you think you were going to do when you grew up?
What I wanted to do was just like any other kid growing up, I wanted to be Larry Bird. Shoot three-pointers. Yeah. Unfortunately, I didn't grow to be 6'9" and have a, become one of the best shooters in the NBA.
Were you a basketball fan as a kid?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, you ended up at Georgia Tech. I grew up in North Carolina. I'm a huge ACC Hoops fan. Was that part of the appeal of Georgia Tech for you undergrad?
Absolutely. So for me, I mean, the best memories I have growing up were with my father going to ACC games, seeing Duke and the rise of Krzyzewski and also seeing the great UNC teams. And then additionally, just the basketball back into that era was just so much fun. I always loved when I was a kid looking at baseball cards, football cards, and looking, trying to find out the relative value that it would exist between a trade that you had with some of your fellow students, and you'd always sometimes want to one-up them just from a competition perspective. And it was always fun.
Yeah.
So I think I naturally just engendered myself to the stocks and bonds from that perspective.
I feel like so many people who end up in a finance career, the analytics around sports was like the gateway drug. The averages and understanding the analytics, like it was how we all started thinking about statistics and the like.
Absolutely.
So you go to Georgia Tech undergrad, you decide to go to Wake Forest for business school. How did you decide on a business career?
Yeah, I mean, I think what happened to me was just going back, I mean, a little bit further. So I graduated from Georgia Tech, and my first job out of internship actually was working on just studying Y2K readiness for Fortune 500 companies. And
we're dating ourselves that we know what Y2K readiness
is.
Yeah,
yeah. And it's also a little bit of a laugh right now because, we're sometimes thinking, hey, is LIBOR, the LIBOR transition, is that the next Y2K?
That's right.
I spent a summer basically just going through K's and Q's and understanding like, hey, which companies we're addressing it or not.
Yeah. After business school, you end up at Voya, then ING, focused on fixed income. Was that the best job that you found? Was there a priority where you said fixed income was important? What drew you to that at that point in your career?
I think, I go to business school at Wake Forest with the notion of, hey, I'm just trying to move my career forward. And, looking to, from a long-term perspective, whether it be investments, investment management, investment banking, something that was focused on just the relative value or also underwriting negotiations. So I found myself, second year business school, best opportunity that I felt like, came out on the board was, right in my backyard.
And what specifically were you doing for them?
So it was interesting. Like where I first started out, it was, hey, I was the quant somewhat, calculating duration, convexity, for an $80 billion insurance platform and working with the PMs to understand, okay, does that make sense from a spread perspective and really trying to, get into the weeds on how should we be pricing these private assets and understanding the pricing matrix on a credit rating and also, average life perspective. And then we would go through and we'd run things like on derivative solutions and FactSet and other things that I'm sure that you know some of the old school folks might remember. But we would also do.
You and I are old enough that this. I mean, I'm sure so much of this is automated now.
But absolutely. But I remember like
that you would get hired to do that. You were their computer back in the day, Robert.
But you would also run, I mean, I realize, hey, you had to come in on a Friday and then let the machine run, you know, for two days, and
hope
nothing bogged down. Otherwise, it would take another day and a half in order to. Get the analytics out to the pricing teams.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you were there from 2006 to 2011, which means your investing time at ING Voya spanned the global financial crisis. Tell me about that experience. I mean, you're in an investing seat in the midst of the most volatile credit markets in generations. What was that experience like, and what lessons did you learn out of that?
I think for me, it was the best, worst time somebody could ever have, because of the fact that on one hand, you had the assets you were managing that you had classified as money good, really just, you know, it's something you thought would always pay back
the,
par.
The sleep at night paper wasn't so
got marked
night.
To market to 70, 60, 50, even 20 cents on the dollar. And then you additionally would see a AAA rating security get put on negative watch, and then all of a sudden have a 13, 14 notch downgrade by the rating agency. So it was a very just tumultuous time.
Sure.
I mean, for us, I mean, when we were looking at it and we were thinking about it, I mean, my wife and I, we always do my joke, but when you see your company stock go from $40 to $3, and then additionally, you're thinking about how, you know, what is this going to impact my life? You know, how is that going to impact, you know, others, you know, within the group? You know, what does this mean for long-term career perspectives? And I think the way I just approached it was like, you know, how can I best help out my team and just, you know, really pitch in, roll up the sleeves? So when we were always looking at like, you know, whether it be CMBS paper, understanding what those tranches would potentially mean. Additionally, always wondering about, okay, like how much risk do we want to take in that certain environment? There were so many just lessons learned, you know, from that perspective. I mean, because
And what were they, Robert? Are there lessons learned from that directly apply today, you know, where we are from a cycle perspective?
Yeah, I think like when your hand gets caught on the oven and it gets burnt, you're really less, you know, you find yourself a lot more risk averse.
You're not reaching for the cast iron skillet again.
You're not reaching for, you know, for more yield.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think what it really taught is just like, as far as there's an old saying, I mean, which I'm sure you've heard Colbert before, but when the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked. And when we were looking at some of these structured product vehicles, there were a lot of risks that we didn't think. I mean, like looking at, you know, the LTV rates, we're also looking at the appraisal values and stabilizations and seeing what the tenancy would be in certain structures and securities. And it was fascinating for me to think about, wow, there's a lot of work, you know, from a re-underwriting perspective that we have to do, because definitely things have been remarked. Those valuations were initially based on a 2007 type appraisal value, like for CMBS.
Sure.
You know, and those LTVs were high. I mean, I saw some that was as high as 102%.
I always feel like if you live through that time, you know, this sort of the trust but verify mantra gets drilled into you, which is there was so much sort of abdication of responsibility to the rating agencies or to whomever just to say, well, this is okay. And if you live through it, you know that you can't rely on that stuff anymore. You've got to do your own work and make sure you really understand what you own.
Yeah. And additionally, it's like those strong hands as far as like, you know, having a good sponsor and really understand the credit worthiness of who was actually backing you.
Who's your partner?
Meant yeah. so much. And
That's
it still
right.
means so much today.
Yeah, no, we agree with that. So you managed through that tumultuous time. You get out to the other side. It's 2011, and you make the decision to move over to the UPS Group Trust. You're coming back home. What drew you to that opportunity at that point in your career?
For me, it was look, when Voya had moved from about 11,000 full-time employees to about 7,000, just like many other financial institutions. So there had been definitely a cut in the workforce. And then additionally, you know, as you're thinking about it, maybe, hey, potential upside opportunity, because the fact that there have been other people that have been staying long, 401ks have been slashed to 201ks. And you're thinking about, hey, how can I, you know, leverage what I've already learned and, you know, take the battle scars that I've, you know, had at Voya and help, you know, continue to help, I would say beneficiaries sort of similar to Voya, but in a different, you know, it's our pension beneficiaries at UPS. So the opportunity became open. I thought it was a fantastic role because of the fact that when they were looking for somebody to comment and, you know, look at managers and also structures and securities, they didn't have anybody. I mean, at the time, to be honest with you.
And before we go down too far the path of what you do day to day today, tell us what the UPS Group Trust is.
Sure. It's a $45 billion defined benefit plan, as to serve 425,000 employees across the United States. And, you know, for us, when we're thinking about it's three distinct plans. There's one non-union plan and two union plans. Both definitely have different characteristics and mixes. One is faster growing than the other. And as we're thinking about just overall structures and things, I mean, I think that the most important thing is that we're characterizing, we're putting together a plan that meets the goals of the UPS Group Trust. We want to make sure that the promises that have been made to our employees, we can deliver on them just like we deliver on a Christmas package. Make sure that we're a very reliable provider of somebody's retirement benefit.
It's part of the culture, right?
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, that makes sense. So then when you first got there, what was your first job? What did you actually step in the door to do there?
So when I first got to UPS, I was the long duration fixed income portfolio manager. But effectively, what on a corporate pension plan, there's so much sensitivity to the long part of the curve. So when I got to the UPS, the 30-year treasury was at a whopping, I think it was about 4.39% in June 30th, 2011. And in the first 90 days, you have S&P default crisis, you had the government shutdown, and the 30-year treasury went from 4.39 to 2.8. And to see, you know, effectively what was fascinating was like in that 30-year instrument, we made 51% in the strip.
And for those who aren't as close to the rates environment, that isn't supposed to happen.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just, you know, a lot of people, when they're looking at the 30-year, I think they look at just the coupon perspective, but there's so much power in the duration and especially the convexity of that instrument. And it's a great hedge for our liability. The problem is that, you know, the long-term forecast, we've always been primarily an open plan. We're going to be freezing our non-union plan. And effectively in a few years, but we've always been focused on returns. So we've always been trying to, you know, one, make sure that we were effectively hedged, but two, also trying to figure out capturing upside opportunities. And I would say that during that time, a lot of sensitivity duration, a lot of corporate, you know, expectations for long-term capital market expectations had to be reset. I'll be frank with you. I never thought we would see a negative yielding security. I mean, you can go back and look at the pig crisis.
Yep.
I mean, seeing Greek 10-year paper at 34% and the day it's priced at about 1.3, fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, to see that the whatever it takes mantra of the ECB has driven yields to the levels that they are today.
And I can't shake the feeling that it's all going to end in tears, but I'm not convinced exactly when. So, you know, we'll see how this all plays out.
I just hope one day I can have a negative mortgage in the United States, but, and I know that's probably going to be asking too much.
That's right. We should all be so lucky. So tell our audience what a typical day in the life of an allocator is. You know, how do you spend your time between thinking through various different asset classes, diligencing new managers, monitoring existing managers? What's the job, Robert?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say when just thinking about it, I mean, just holistically, I mean, you walk into the office and you probably have like, you know, a set of things of, hey, people you want to, you know, potentially get back at, look at new ideas. I'd say, you know, when I was thinking about what my role in explaining to other people would be, you know, four real components: portfolio construction, trying to understand what we want, what we don't want. I'd say one thing that we really haven't believed in, for instance, would be long short credit. We think it's very expensive. We think it's very costly.
And tough business.
And rates are low and it's very expensive. So we've cut a lot of that allocation out of our portfolio. You know, I'd say the other part is sourcing/pacing.
What do you mean by that, Robert?
So when I'm saying sourcing, it's like, you know, look, you've got your managers that you have and you have liquid or illiquid exposures and you're thinking about, wow, if I made a commitment on a certain fund or, you know, not necessarily or a separate account or something else that was, you know, that we were trying to get exposure to, how long am I going to be in that vehicle? What does that mean? I mean, does that mean, because it's usually if you're in a liquid investment, you can't get all the money out day one. Now, the wonderful thing about high yield and some of the public assets is, yeah, I can put the money out, but I'm usually not going to get the liquidity premium that I get relative to the illiquid markets. So when we think about like, hey, what levers do I have to pull in order to get the returns that my beneficiaries need? I look at it and go, I got really three. I've got illiquidity premium. We want about roughly 200 basis points. I can go lower down in credit or, you know, slash, you know, in capital structure there. Really, you know, rather stay senior. Don't really, you know, I'm not a big fan. You know, I mean, triple C's. I mean, I
think burning your hand on the stove again.
And then additionally, I think the other thing that sometimes we look at is leverage. And I think the view we've had is that, look, I'm better off usually levering up a higher quality asset that we feel like, wow, it's going to really stand the test of time, than going down in credit. If I really need to get, you know, additional returns, levering up like a high quality asset, whether it be in derivatives or, and we don't need too much of it. We try to just make sure, hey, we've got that tool on our belt.
Part of the toolkit.
If we need it.
Well, let me unpack a couple of things you mentioned there. You know, a big part of your job is picking the right firms to deploy capital on your behalf. How do you do that well? What is your test of what makes a good manager?
I think the first thing is, I mean, track record matters a lot. I don't like to be the first fund entrant. I mean, I literally sometimes even want to say, hey, what success or failures have you had in the market, you know, managing this capital? For instance, like a direct lending fund. I mean, there's been a lot of money that's been raised recently for direct lending. But there haven't been a lot of guys that have been around for 15, 20 years doing so. Track record matters a lot. I think then finally, okay, after that, you also want to make sure it's a people business. How are the people that are going to be managing the investments? What are they going to be doing with your capital? Walk me through deals. We'll also look at like loan docs sometimes, just saying, hey, can we look not just the investment
for the underlying deals,
for the under deals, the under deals. We'll just say, hey, you know, do you mind if we just spend an hour or two just going through your loan docs and seeing what they look like? You know, some are more willing than others, to be honest. But I think it's just imperative that, you know, in my role, just understanding what the risks are.
This has been a huge topic of conversation for us internally, because what you've seen is the weakening of loan docs in the broadly syndicated market to a point where there are broadly syndicated big deals where what you think is first lien may not actually be first lien. I mean, it's just, it's crazy what's happened. And we feel like, especially at this point in the cycle, you have to maintain your discipline from a documentation perspective. Like, this is when people really have, you know, it's your point about the tides going out. Like, that is when the loan docs all get exposed.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the other thing too, Colbert, that I'd mentioned too, is that, you know, not just the covenant light aspect that you mentioned. I mean, to see 80% covenant light currently in the market, but it's also the diligence light activities.
Yep.
A manager that for some reason, because of the fact there is such a competitive environment for certain deals, have they done the diligence that you think they should have? Or has it been a 5-day term sheet turnaround that in order
Kirkland
to get
and Ellis grid?
To fill out the grid and we'll get back to you to see if you got it or not, but you got to get back to us in 3 to 5 days. And it's, those are the type of things that, you know, we're worried about, because like a lot of these funds or fee structures, they're private equity like fees. So you want to make sure that you're getting private equity like diligence on our investments.
That's right. Yeah. It makes complete sense. I definitely don't need to know any names, but surely at some point in your career, you have made a mistake on a manager. What were your lessons learned from that?
I think that a few things would be, you know, trust but verify. And always looking at, you know, the sort of a game theory perspective. I mean, like as far as what has the manager told me and can he quantifiably back it up? If we have a situation, for instance, that somebody had said, hey, it's a senior in the capital structure, we're getting above market return and we're taking less risk in the overall market, I think some people's eyes should raise. I
mean, when something's
what
too
is
good
the
to
additional
be true, it usually
risk
is. Yeah.
That they've taken, and there usually is something. And I think that, you know, thankfully, I mean, like I can knock on wood and say that, you know, for the most part, I mean, like the investments I've underwritten, I feel, you know, pretty strong in saying that I've had a good track record. But I do think that, you know, there's been some luck in that too. There's also, you know, I think that when we look at things, and we have a very stringent structured process. We do any manager underwriting, we want to make sure that we do an investment memo. So we'll, before we do any diligence, we'll do a preclearance memo, and we'll make sure that we go in and just write the thesis, memorialize the opportunity that we feel like the manager has with us, and try to underwrite the returns and get an expectation. Now, I think that, look, I could make a 100 or 200 page investment memo and I may not capture all the right things. And look, I don't do 100 page memos. I may do 15 or 20,
but you do the work.
I do the work. And I think like it's also good from the perspective of, if you miss something, why did you miss it? You know, I would say that if there was one thing that I think that we've really been surprised at is the liberal use of capital call and leverage facilities that has percolated in the market recently by some of the managers. And that I cannot pay my beneficiaries out on IRR. I can pay them out on multiple, but I can't pay them out on IRR.
You got to put dollars to work.
So yeah. So the thing that we've really focused on is just understanding what those games sometimes, and not saying all GPs, but some GPs may use in order to gain their IRRs.
Well, and it's interesting. I mean, you make the point about the analytical work on the front end, and I always feel like if something goes wrong, you can't adequately post-mortem it and figure out the mistakes made if you hadn't done enough work on the front end. You can go back and see, what did I miss? But if you didn't actually have that 15, 20, like, robust memo, you know, you can't actually sanity check it a year down the road and say, hold on a second, I know I missed something here. You mentioned public versus private credit before, and you have a broad remit of credit within your portfolio. First of all, let's just, for everybody's benefit, what's the difference in your mind between private and public credit? How should we think about those as broad asset classes? And then we'll talk a little bit about the benefits and downsides of each.
I think, first of all, if I can sell it in the public markets, and if I can sell it within, let's just say, look, I mean, 2 week to even a 3 month type period, and I can get, you know, wonderful execution. Just because I can sell it doesn't mean it's liquid.
Right.
I mean, I think that's the...
Also, just because it's called liquid doesn't mean you can sell it, in my experience.
Yeah, that's completely right. Yeah. I think that when we were when we go through and we're looking at certain investments from a private-public perspective, first of all, I mean, I'd say, like, look, what is the investment? Okay. Is it, if you can't sell, what is the issue size? What is the EBITDA multiple? How does this compare to a comparable public market bond? And therefore, if you do the underwriting and if you're looking at something, you know, A relative to B, and if it's illiquid, there should be some sort of illiquidity premium that's associated with that structure. So we definitely like liquidity. I mean, anybody would, but if you can get paid for illiquidity, and if you think about the 17, 18 year liability that the EPS Group Trust has, it made a lot of sense for us to structure and find things that we felt like, wow, even though they were liquid, they, you know, represent good opportunities that we can capture spread and more than anything, focus on, you know, high risk adjusted returns.
So you've been invested for a while. That landscape, private credit, as I understand it, has evolved quite a bit. How has the landscape changed in the purview over the last 6 or 7 years as you guys have been looking at the space?
I think that the biggest thing would be that there's more money. We really saw, I think we weren't early, but we definitely weren't late. I think that there's a lot of people that sometimes look at a 4 to 6 times leveraged loan. And just think about this for a second. It's definitely not an asset class for all seasons. I mean, it's definitely not an all-weather asset class. It is a risky instrument that you've levered up on a loan structure. And look, I mean, it requires potentially a lot of care to manage a certain situation. But I still maintain it is a very strong investment. So when we look at BB/B type risk, great risk. I still think the greatest trade that, you know, if you can find IG risk and get compensated high yield returns for that risk, do it all day long.
Yeah. Not that easy to find
it's
anymore.
It's not easy to find, but, you know, sometimes, you know, there are opportunities. I mean, the market can and will, they will punish things.
Yeah.
Sometimes very extreme. Sometimes too extreme.
Yeah. When you think about, we talked a little bit about portfolio construction before, and this is broader than just private credit, but just as you think about investing in private credit managers, as an example, do you typically like to concentrate with a single manager? Do you spread it among a group? Do you like having different flavors of private credit exposure? How do you think about the right way to invest?
Yeah, I'd say, first of all, we like diversification. We don't want to, you know, put all the eggs in one basket with one manager. So in private credit, I would say that we're focused on not just direct lending, though, but it could be something like a distressed opportunity, or you could also get into to potentially mezz. Additionally, you know, I'd say that we've spent a lot of time in structured credit. I mean, I'd say that within CDX, we're also CLOs and understanding, okay, where potentially great opportunities could be. I think there's some fantastic opportunities still in structuring investments where you get you're higher in the capital structure. You're definitely not taking a first loss position. You can find some really above market compensation at times. So, yeah, I think that when we're thinking about, okay, this pool of capital that we're trying to manage within credit, you want diversification, you want great opportunities, but you've got to get compensation for that risk.
You'd mentioned before, you know, we are late cycle, and you talked about saying more senior at this point in the cycle. How do you think about senior versus junior type credit opportunities, given where we are from a macro perspective?
I'd say, first of all, I mean, we look at pricing, for instance, from S&P, Refinitiv, Wells Fargo research, and when we're sort of thinking about trying to make investments at this point, we're very cognizant of what actually exists in the market. So, you know, first rule, I mean, I think invest in, like, know the market. Okay, after you know the market, what is that compensation for the risk? And I think, like, in general, what we see is that we find, okay, if you can clip up, you know, a couple hundred basis points, maybe 100 basis, 200 basis points, a non-sponsor relationship. But if the manager that is underwriting and doing those transactions finds something that they feel like, wow, it's giving me that additional compensation, I think that's great. But you've got to find a manager that look at the realized losses, look at the non-accruals that are in the portfolio. Where are the landmines?
Yeah, that's you say. You got to do the work, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned this before. You do think about macro, and part of your job is understanding sort of where we are from a big picture. I want to pull back a little bit. What is your overall outlook for the credit markets? How concerned are you about, you know, the fragility of where we are from a cycle perspective?
I think that the biggest concern, which you noted on earlier, is the culprit is, like, you know, the deterioration of what that credit agreement looks like and the levers that you can potentially pull from a covenant perspective. So the covenant light perspective is something that, I mean, it gets a lot of headlines, but I think that it's definitely noted.
And you made this point before. I mean, a 4 to 6 times levered company is risky. Well, it's levered. Well, so, but what if that EBITDA isn't actually EBITDA, right? The underlying earnings of a business, you know, you're allowing these sponsors to add back 25, 30, whatever percent with no backup for whatever that is. So 6 times is actually far more levered than that actually implies.
And the adjusted EBITDA add backs over the last 3 to 5 years have been somewhat obscene.
Yeah.
The real folks that I think sometimes are going to be impacted by this new the relaxed credit work actually could be the distressed guys. Because once they try to take that company over, are they going to have the real levers that are going
to
be—
Does the doc have
teeth to do it? I mean, I think it's been fantastic for private equity guys in this environment to potentially, you know, stick it to the creditors. But after it goes, the borrower stops paying, what does that mean for the distress, you know, situation?
Well, and it's interesting. I mean, how we've thought about that is I agree with you completely on large cap distressed. If you think about, you know, broadly syndicated distressed documents, you just have a document that's very weak and it's very hard for a creditor to actually assert it and protect its interests. You know, there's enough discipline still in especially the smaller, more, you know, private credit distressed world. I think that's going to be a huge opportunity going forward because smaller market caps, less people following them, and a document that at least has some facsimile of what we actually think of a credit agreement supposed to look at. Let me move now, Robert, to the last segment of the podcast, which is something that we call best ideas. You know, in our line of work, we often think about sizing a position or an investment depending on how good an idea is. Only good ideas make it into our portfolio, but an investment could be small, medium, or large based on whether it's a good, better, or best idea. So with that framework, in this segment, we talk about our best ideas outside of work. Robert, you're our guest, so we're going to ask you to go first. What's your best idea?
So my best idea right now is actually comes from I heard Jim Mattis speak the other day. Fantastic former Secretary of Defense. But he really loves to read about history. And he made a quote from George Washington. He said, "Men who are familiarized with danger meet it without shrinking, whereas troops unused to service often apprehend danger where no danger is." And I think the message that he was trying to say is that the key is to prepare for what the, you know, might come before and really work on imaging. And I took that from a real perspective, whether it be from a personal perspective, like even if you're not currently in the fight, what does the battle scenario, war game scenario type look like when we are going through a great financial crisis, when we're going through a credit crisis, structuring documents, but additionally, just from a personal perspective, just looking at, you know, like, what are the new opportunities that potentially exist too? I thought that there was so much to be learned right now. I mean, I think the other thing that I thought about additionally is just civility. Sometimes even it would exist with, there's no civility currently that's existing in this perpetual election cycle within the United States. And, you know, hopefully we get to an end on that. But additionally, I mean, as far as respect and just understanding, I mean, like finding win-win situations, there's a lot to be learned from the book's called Call Sign Chaos.
So, yeah. So General Mattis, he wrote a book called Call Sign Chaos. So the best idea from Robert Thompson this week. I typically offer up a best idea inspired by my guest each week. You live in Atlanta. And I was down in Atlanta earlier this year, and I want to make a specific Atlanta recommendation. I am a huge football fan. I love football. I love watching football. And I'd never been to a Super Bowl in my life and was very lucky enough to be able to go this year for the first time. My parents are both from Boston. I live a lifelong Patriots fan. And despite the low-scoring game, I was thrilled about the outcome. But my recommendation is Atlanta's Mercedes-Benz Stadium, home of the Falcons and your MLS soccer team, Atlanta United. I say that because in the pantheon of recently built stadiums, it doesn't get talked about as much. Like, you get all the buzz as, you know, AT&T in Dallas, and I was blown away by how great that stadium is. In particular, I thought the Jumbotron in the top is incredible, the sort of circular Jumbotron. It's a huge design feature, great sight lines. I just thought it was amazing. I'm a big fan of your hometown. I'm a big fan of that stadium. And my recommendation for this week is Atlanta's Mercedes-Benz. With that, Robert, thank you. We really appreciate you taking the time today. You know you're a busy man. You've got a lot going on. So appreciate you coming on the podcast this week.
Thank you, Colbert.
Thanks again to our guest, Robert Thompson. Take a look at the episode description if you'd like to learn more about UPS Group Trust, and you can also find the book he recommended, Call Sign Chaos by General Jim Mattis. And thank you to our listeners. We appreciate you all tuning in. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Check out the show notes to find links to some of our best ideas, and remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. We'll be back next week with a new episode, but in the meantime, please rate and review us on your favorite podcast app.